This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. Today, we're talking about romantic relationships. But first, we'll get into some research and start with the Harvard University Longitudinal Study of 1938. So I'll read some of the information we found on that. It followed 724 participants, the longest running study in history, with key results showing that happiness and health aren't a result of wealth, fame, or working hard, but come instead from relationships. So not just romantic relationships, but how healthy our relationships are with family as a way to support our mental health and happiness. So what are your thoughts, Annie?
It's really great that that's like running an ongoing study, because I think relationships and healthy relationships with other people are, first of all, obviously having a good support network and thereby having really well looked after mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't really come as a huge surprise, but I'm glad they've confirmed it and to see the results of a study that was 75 years long, I believe.
Goodness.
Next up, from mentalhealth.org, they carried out a review of 148 studies and concluded the influence of social relationships on the risk of death is comparable with well-established risk factors for mortality, such as smoking and alcohol consumption, and exceed the influence of other risk factors, such as physical inactivity and obesity. So a stat like that is quite shocking, just to show how much negative relationships can affect your health in general and even your mortality. And that's not to say that don't get in a relationship, but I think sometimes it takes stats that are shocking enough to have us question our behavior and what it takes to look after ourselves. There are many cases where it can feel like the more grown up or safe thing to do to stay in a relationship, even if it's challenging. But there's a clear distinction between when it's obstacles and natural ups and downs in a relationship you need to work through, and when a relationship is actively toxic and bad for you, like the abusive relationship we talk about in today's episode. And further to that, another of the findings in this research was that people in unhappy or negative relationships have significantly worse outcomes than those who are isolated or have no relationship. So again, that's an important one to note, where at times it can feel like you're still better off with somebody than you are alone. And I've certainly been guilty of that feeling myself, but it's not the case. And I'm really glad that we were able to find research that justifies that. Because sometimes that's what you need to hear, that you will be okay on your own and you can take a break from relationships and that's okay. And that's definitely been something that's helped me in terms of recovering from difficult relationships, in particular one that I mentioned in the episode. But also, it's really important to take a break between relationships, particularly longer ones, as a way to kind of refresh and check back in with yourself and what you want out of them, and go in hopefully with less carried over baggage as a result of taking that time to recover and recharge in many ways. Certainly in cases of abusive relationships like the one we're going to talk about today, it can so fundamentally undermine your self-esteem that sometimes people will need this kind of reminding of the extent to which a relationship can harm you. That actually, because of it, you staying safe and you protecting your mental health should be coming above anything in a relationship, because if it's harming you, it doesn't matter how loyal you are to them, how long you've been together, how confident you are you'll meet somebody else. You've got to protect your own mental health. And also, absolutely, that's the only way to be a good partner in a healthy relationship as well.
Yeah, I think the healthier relationships are sometimes the more constructively selfish ones, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way of putting it, constructively selfish. Because
absolutely.
Sometimes you have to be, in the same way people use the phrase constructive criticism. Things that can be seen as generally negative are often needed for people's personal growth.
Yeah, they're really important. And I think that when we grow up, we're taught to put others ahead of ourselves quite a lot. And I think the real adulting comes when you realize that sometimes you have to be selfish to keep yourself safe. That's something that's been a massive learning curve for me in my early adulthood, as I'm now sort of into full mega adulthood. Oh my God.
So we'll round up on that there and get to talking about our guest. She is a repeat guest called Emma Burdett, who was first on the podcast last year. She's a really incredible person who goes around schools and teaches mental health, engaging people, that I know makes such a difference to so many young lives. Catch up with her again, and this time talk about how relationships have really fed into where her mental health has been through her life and even up to now. Anything you want to say, Annie? I know you're a big fan of her.
Yeah, I love Emma. She's so lovely. And I'm just really, really glad we've got her back on the podcast again, because she's so insightful, as you say. And I love listening to her and you chat all things mental health.
All right, so we'll get into the episode in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Emma Burdett. My mental health journey for me began when I was around about 8 or 9 years old, and I've always been into acting, and we had a school show and I've been picked to be the lead, and I remember everyone in my class really being quite supportive of me, but I didn't really feel anything. It was almost this numbness, and I obviously at the time didn't know what that was, but looking back, that's the first thing for me that I can think of. Okay, I should have really been quite happy about that. I've been picked to be the lead role there, and it was something that was a passion of mine, but I just remember this just general sort of haze of numbness. And then going on from that, went into sort of secondary school, where I just didn't find enjoyment through things that I was good at, through things that I was good at and also enjoyed. So, for instance, I was always a fast runner. I loved competing. However, if I won, I didn't feel happy from it. It was just lots of people would come up congratulating me. I just remember this. And I'd almost be embarrassed by it. And I also, I'm not sure if I mentioned it on the last podcast, I used to play for Tottenham Hotspur's football club as the goalkeeper. And that, again, was quite an achievement. And even now, sometimes people randomly Google me and they say, oh, you played for Spurs. And I just find it so, I think I blush. It's like anything with an achievement that is seen as like, yeah, an achievement, something as of a success. For me, I think, yeah, I just find it quite awkward, probably the word I'd use. And definitely when it went on to, so I wasn't, it was until I was about 24. Five, maybe a little bit earlier, when I was diagnosed with having, it was depression and anxiety. And then I started having some counselling, things like that later on. And then things were linked back. And that's when I had to pull back on these sorts of thoughts and things. But it all linked over, I think, from having quite low self-esteem growing up. And I was never, so I was very happy like with my upbringing things. But we come from a very modest family. My dad, he was a very successful teacher. Even now he's retired, but he's really good at playing table tennis and he'll just win all these awards, but he won't tell me. I'll just see it online that he's won all these things. So you just, they're very humble, very modest, and they could boast and brag about a lot of things, but they never do, which I think is great. But I think in terms of growing up, I never had any of those moments in being like, yes, I'm really proud of that, or yeah, let's actually be happy for myself. So I think that's things that I've always, and I still am, trying to work on and being like, no, I should be proud about that. That's an achievement. Let's just be proud. And I think going back to the sort of low self-esteem, that then translated into relationships. I think my first proper relationship was with someone who I worked with. I had a gap year. So this is after sixth form. So I was about 17, 18, 18 years old. I worked in this shop for a gap year, and he was the deputy manager, and he was 31 at the time, so there's quite a age gap there, but he was a very good looking man. And right then I was like, wow, I was still in this sort of thing that when you come from school, well, at least for my school, it was you were popular if you had a good-looking older boyfriend. That was these boxes that would be ticked. And I remember just thinking, okay, I quite like this man. I was the only girl who worked for this shop, and quite a few of them there were taking an interest in me. Again, because I didn't have much, I'd say, self-worth, self-esteem, even though I knew that they liked me, I would tell myself, oh, no, it's just competition or whatever. There's nothing real to it. But I did quite enjoy the attention. And so I ended up getting with the deputy manager. And then it was a few months in, and it was this sort of whirlwind thing. It was nice. He told me he loved me, and that was the first time that anyone had ever said that to me. And I remember he said that to me in Wetherspoons, of all places. Looking back now, I'm like, if I was now on a date with someone, I was with a boyfriend, they tell me they love me in Wetherspoons, I think that's a sign to get out. But at that time, I just remember when he said it, and I could feel my eyes welling up, and I never used to show any sort of emotion. I was always quite sort of, yeah, isolated, almost like an island in terms of how I sort of give off things. But I remember thinking, oh my gosh, he's going to crack me. He's just said that he loves me. This is amazing. And I think then he basically hooked me in there, and I was besotted with him. But then a few months on, and he told me, this was a key bit, he told me not to tell anyone at work. So he said, because...
So tell you that he loved you, or tell you... Tell them that you were in a relationship.
Yeah.
Okay.
He wanted to keep the whole thing a secret. And because I was so young, I thought, oh, well, it's quite exciting. But then as a few weeks went on, I thought, well, no, actually, this feels almost that he's not proud that he's with me. And I wanted to also feel sort of bad for using this word, but I'm going to be honest. I wanted to show him off, because I was thinking, yeah, I'm with this really attractive man. I kept on focusing on that because there was nothing else there when you look back on it. He was funny, but that was it. He's not someone who I'd probably, if I had much self-worth, would now find very funny. But at the time, I found him funny. And yes, so he kept it a secret. And I brought it up with him, and I just said, look, you know, I'd like you to meet my friends because I really like you, and if there's a future. And he'd always sort of, he'd start using these manipulative ways. He'd just say, oh, no, if we're the real deal, then we should just work on the two of us for now. And then later down the line, then, of course, yeah, we'll meet each other's friends. He then...
It's funny you've mentioned that, because it reminds me of a conversation I had with a friend a few years ago where she was with this guy and there was a lot of red flags, weird situations, like he lived with his nephew and we didn't quite know why, and... It turned out in hindsight that was actually his son, and all kinds of odd things. And like, he wanted her to move in like very quickly. And I think that was partly to like help mind his son and all these kind of weird things. And I remember having a conversation with her of being like, so are you guys official now? Because this has been going on for some time. And she said, well, we're too grown. We don't need these kind of labels. And I was like, I don't know, I think the labels are an important part of a grown-up relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah, you need to know in your own mind as well, what is this, what is going on? Because also, well, you could be dating other people or whatever, especially in the world of Tinder and things.
So and with this example, it turned out there was another woman on the go, and so then it seems, well, it was the baby's mom was still in the picture. So it all then seemed quite convenient, but yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it's reminded me of.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, actually, I don't think it's going to be too dissimilar. Yeah, so with this one, and so he cut off, and what I realised I did, and it's something that I'm always slightly aware of, because I think when you go through, you know, I'm 31 now, and then you do, you know, you look back on your relationships and what habits or patterns are formed sometimes. And I know that when I'm a single person, I go really all out independent. And I love that. And I feel like I'm really thriving. But when I get in relationships, I do sometimes, I give myself to that person too much. And going back to this first one, what should I call him? Mr. K.
Mr. Kellogg's.
Mr. Kellogg's. Then, yeah, I completely shut out all my friends. So they were wanting to meet up with me. But because that he, Mr. K, had said that he doesn't want to meet people yet, because we weren't at that stage and he wanted us to just work on each other, he wouldn't meet them. And so I was besotted with the man. So I just ended up slowly cutting off all my friends. And so then I became really isolated. So then he could say whatever he wanted and I would believe him because he had now become my world.
Yeah, because abuse flourishes in isolation.
Absolutely. And what he did that really made it quite difficult was he moved three doors apart from where I was living. I was living with my parents at the time, and he moved three doors down.
Wow.
Yeah. And he wouldn't tell anyone who we were working with still. So I'm in this completely secretive relationship, but I'm spending all my time with this person, but no one's met them. My mum and dad were keeping themselves to themselves. I think they were quite concerned, but didn't want to be seen to get too involved.
And they knew the relationship was going on.
They knew that I was seeing someone, but they had never met him. They probably
and they didn't know that he was just living down the road.
I think I mentioned that he was down the road. I think for them at the time, they've said previously, it was quite awkward for them because they wanted me to be independent. And it was because as then I'm not a child because I was 18, 19... But they, I think, quite concerned is probably the right wording without putting words in their mouth. Yes, so I'm now almost living with him because he wanted to see me all the time. He's not wanting me to see other people. I'm only wanting to see him. He's living three doors down. So I'm spending all this time in his flat, three doors away from where my parents are. And so I'm completely just shut off. And I remember it was just when I was, so I'm on this sort of gap year working and I was doing this acting course at Rose Bruford. And I wanted to, for him, for my final piece, this big performance. And so I said to him, oh, it'd be really good if you can come and watch me for this final piece. And he said, oh, yeah, definitely. He knew that my parents would be there and some university friends as well, I think. And it got to the day, and I just remember I got a text from him, and I was like, oh, no, sorry, babe, can't make it. And I felt absolutely gutted, but also it was this feeling of I expected it as well. So we move on.
And out of interest with your self-worth being where it was, did you feel it was in any way deserved, that you were kind of, he was treating you in a way that you deserved?
Yeah, I think we'd had, it wasn't like shouty arguments. It was like when there's no conversation, it's almost like sulking talk. He'd always say, so he wouldn't like it. It was a controlling thing looking back. He wouldn't like it, even though he hadn't asked me to move in. He wouldn't like it if I go home to my parents, even though that's where I lived, because he was only three doors away. If I got up to leave, he'd say, well, where are you going? You know, if I'm your boyfriend, you know, this is your future, you should be staying here.
Yeah, no, the reason I ask is because it kind of makes sense how he was treating you and how manipulative it was. It can feel more appropriate in a context of your standards being lower.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think I definitely, and when I look back at even photos, I mean, there's none of me with him because he wouldn't appear in any, but I can see just from looking at myself, I didn't look like me. I don't know, like my eyes just look sort of dead. And it's just not me. When I look at it, I'm sort of, I'm still a little bit angry with how I was, even though you have to, you know, give yourself the benefit of the doubt as long as you learn from it. But I do wish I'd just slapped him in the face. Obviously not with violence, just with words.
Metaphorically.
Yes, that's the one. So, yeah, this went on for a little while. And then it gets to, we've been with each other a few months. It had felt like a lot longer because it was so intense. And then he's been all off with me at work. And I didn't understand. He's been very cold to me. And I just said to him, look, what is this? And it was just as he's about to go out the back of the shop. So I'm still on the shop floor. He's about to get out there. And he just said, look, he said, you young people, you don't know anything. He said, you think the world revolves around you. I've just found out I'm going to be a dad. So you need to grow up. And then he slammed the door and went out the back. And so I'm just left there with a load of customers thinking, what on earth? And I just remember trying to serve these customers in this weird haze, thinking, what does he mean? I couldn't properly speak to him because he then just vanished after work. So it was all these sort of mind games of then me just thinking, OK, I can't tell anyone what's going on. I don't understand. Has he cheated on me? What is this?
And how was your mental health at that point? Because I imagine your anxiety could be through the roof.
Absolutely. You start thinking of so many different things. Yeah, I thought, has he cheated on me? What is this? Is it someone from before? And again, the whole self-worth thing. It was very much, I deserve it again. And I still am not too sure where it came from, but I just thought, oh, great, okay. Now, I've never really been a very sort of maternal person, especially when I was 19. And so the idea of this sort of baby being introduced in such a vague way, this is how I know how he'd really got into my head. Because then he said to me, so I wanted to go off onto university to do acting. I got into university in this time frame, and then he said, no, if we're going to be bringing up a baby together, then I don't want you to go to university, especially to do acting. He's like, there's no future in it. He said, get a normal job.
Did you even know whose baby this was at that point?
Well, all I could get out of him was that he had been with someone. It was his old university friend or something.
Right.
He'd met up with them, had a one-night stand. And then she'd messaged him to say, that in, I think it was...
And that was whilst you were together?
No. So this is what he said. He said it had been actually quite a few months beforehand. He'd met up with her, had a one-night stand, didn't think anything of it. But then when she's messaged him, she said something like, I'm 8 months pregnant, 7 or 8. So we didn't have much time until this baby's born. And he was saying that he wants to be a dad and it's all he's ever wanted. And realistically, that's what I should have said. Okay, well, thank you, goodbye. This relationship's not going anywhere. But because of all these mind games, I still was trying to make it work. So I went out, I got a job as an estate agent. I thankfully didn't turn down my place at university. So I had been offered one, but I didn't turn it down. I just sort of left it there. This was in the summer. This was around about August.
And that was under his encouragement to
absolutely
get a job as salary.
Yes.
So and he could provide for this baby.
Yes. So I would be going out to earn money to pay for this child, which I'd never wanted, which had nothing to do with me, in this sort of loveless relationship. And I hadn't met this mother. So it was all this weird world that he had basically created and put on me.
But also when you're spending that much time with him at work and then always also at his home, it's your world too. Like you've kind of stepped inside his own fantasy land.
Yes, absolutely. That was the complete thing. And then what we do is I think I was trying to then hang on to this relationship because it had then pretty much what you've just said, it had become my world. So I was so scared of getting rid of it, even though I knew this is not making me happy. But I thought, I've now cut off any ties I had with my friends. I didn't have a support network, so I couldn't speak to anyone and say that this is what's happening. Because, of course, they would say, well, get the hell out. But I had no one to speak to. So instead, I was just really trying to think, OK, how can I make this work? Right, he needs someone to earn some money. I'll go out and do this. I'm still slightly shocked by it, but... Yeah, it then got to the point, so we'd try and meet up occasionally after work, but again, it's still having to be done in secret. And he'd stand me up, and so there'd be times that we'd meet at some, it would always be some budget pub type thing. He wouldn't be there, and I remember one time, it was again that same Wetherspoons where he told me he loved me. I turned up, he was there, he said for me to get him a drink, I went off to get him a drink, and then came back and he'd gone. So he was just doing these mind games thing, and this group of men had seen me, and they took pity on me, and were like, oh, come and sit with us, darling. And I felt so just disgusting, because I felt like, I remember I just thought, I just want to burst into tears, but these men were there all trying to be nice, but also being basically perverts. But so I'm sat there just thinking, what on earth is happening? And then he just texts me and he said, oh, you bored me. And it was like, oh, what on earth? Then I think if we fast forward a bit more, so I didn't take that job as the estate agent. I turned it down. So, but we still didn't break up. But I just thought, I cannot do this.
There's just one thing I wanted to pick up on that. It's interesting hearing that experience, because I think what a lot of people won't realise is that that unreliability can be so common in abusive relationships. And I've been in one myself, and that was very much part of it, that it was when my business was a lot newer and she was a big part of it. And so she would constantly let me down as a way of creating this reliance that actually, looking back, I didn't need her around as much as I thought I did. But because it would always be a case of, oh, you've got this event on, I'll help out with it. Or you've got this meeting, I'll come along and take notes. Then that would set that standard in my mind of, I need you for these things.
Yes.
For her to only like turn up late, or for me to essentially have to beg or convince her to actually turn up for something she'd volunteered for. And so it creates this false need that's actually just entirely created by that other person.
Yeah, and it creates anxiety as well. And it stops you from growing. I think it's almost like putting a lid on something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you think that you need them in your life to perform at your best.
Yes. Yeah. Actually completely exactly what you said. It's like, without them, we can't do anything. We can't grow. Like, they are watering our little seeds, but in actual fact, they're not. They're poison for us, but we don't know that. Yeah. It was. Yeah. So if we fast forward to a few more months, so I've turned down the estate agent job. He wasn't happy about that, but I said, look, I need to go off to university. He then started pulling these other things, saying, you're going to be meeting all these other men. How can I know you won't cheat on me? And I said, well, there's no way I'm going to cheat on you. I've never cheated on anyone in my life. And he said, oh, no, you women, you're all the same. I also remember, it's just come into my mind, I said to him over like one of our only meals we ever went on, I said to him, oh, have you learned anything from being with me? And he said, oh, no. He said, I won't learn anything from being with you. You'll learn everything from being with me because I'm older.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. But also what you said before that was a real red flag, because I'm yet to come across any relationships where one partner is constantly like assuming the other one is going to cheat, where it's not either projection over like past baggage or they're currently cheating themselves and they're trying to put that on the other person.
Yes, absolutely. And it turned out, because again, he's three doors down. I think it was the time I had spoken about when he stood me up and vanished while in Wetherspoons, or it was another time. But then he had said, oh, now I'm at home. This is all just through text or whatever. So then I drive round. I'm just chasing him like a, you know, woman possessed. But I should have just been like, all right, have a good night, bye. But instead I wanted to find where he was. Sometimes I'd find him in a different pub. Yeah, I'd find him back at his flat, but then I was knocking on the door, and he shares this flat, so other people could hear as well. So it's sort of like my dignity, you know. And I'm knocking on the door, calling for him, and then he just texted me and said, "Oh, shut up, I'm with someone else now." And yeah, I remember seeing this text, and again, just almost knowing it, thinking like, right. And this is now, I've just started university, so it's while Freshers Week's going on, so I should be like going out there and socialising, but instead this has just consumed my mind. So I was probably the worst person to be around as well, because I was just spaced out all the time, really, just not quite knowing how to process this, or can I speak to when I felt I couldn't. And I'm just meeting new people, so you don't want to be nice and, oh, hi, nice to meet you. My boyfriend is currently having a baby with someone else and probably sleeping with someone else at this moment.
But also, was it still all secret at this point?
Yes, yeah, it was always a secret.
And so that, you know, that had not only set that standard, but like you said, it isolates you. And so then you weren't going to think even to speak to somebody else about it, because all you knew was, oh, this is a secret relationship. That's the parameters you're working at.
Yes, it got to a point in one of the days, because when I started at university, I still stayed at this shop just at the weekends, just to try and keep some money coming in. And he was just so horrible to me. And I hated this whole secret thing. And there was one bit I ended up paying for so much. So he was the deputy manager, but yeah, I paid for about, got a big tattoo done. I paid for that. I think he meant iPod. This is back in the day, you know, that was £300. I took out a loan for him, all of this stuff. And I was at the age, this was my first ever things about money, because yeah, I hadn't got any debt up to that point. But then, so my first thing was very much like, oh, okay, yeah, no, I want to, because I've got a job, let me buy him something to feel that I'm independent. And he'd say, oh, yeah, it's a bit of a problem. When I get paid, I'll give you the money. But it never happened.
And did you feel a need to support him?
Yes, I
because
definitely
did. I think what can happen in relationships like that is that the other person kind of holds receipts. And so they'll be very quick to tell you about 10 things that they've done for you and how your life is so brilliant thanks to them. And of course, on the other side of that, which is really the right way to go about it, you would never think to do that.
Yes.
You know, in certainly in healthy relationships I've been in, I would never think to like keep a mental list of things I've done for them and they've done for me, because you're just there to support each other. It's not a tally system.
Yes, absolutely. It ended up that I was paying out for quite a few things, and again, I was a student with just a little part-time job, so I didn't financially, I wasn't really, you know, doing overly well, but I was getting him things for his flat because he wasn't really getting anything there. So I'm trying to put down this sort of almost make a little home, but out of my own money. He wasn't doing any of that. And I remember before I knew it, because as he wanted me to move in, but he didn't ever invite me to live there. So gradually, because otherwise it was awkward, me waking up there and then going three doors to quickly get my clothes or whatever. Gradually, my things are getting into this flat, but also like my PlayStation, things like that, and my TV. And yeah, so it got to this point where I was just so miserable, and I'm at work and he just said something, but slide to me or something, and he'd abandoned me on the shop floor, and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. So I remember I just thought, I had this moment, I just walked out the shop and I walked into another shop, because of course I'm absolutely broke, so I knew I couldn't, you know, but I knew I could not stay there. And I spoke to the person there, and this was, yeah, it would have been round about September, October time. I said, do you have any jobs going? And they did. Actually happened from that, I got a job somewhere else, so then I could leave this place. So at least I was getting out of the working environment.
Yeah.
Before I left, so lots of them said, why are you going? We don't understand. Because they had no idea. And I told this one guy, the first guy who sort of trained me up at the beginning. So I've been working there about 2 years now. And I confided in him. And I said, look, I'm seeing this guy. It's been going on for a while.
And were you feeling a lot of pressure to kind of like cover up your emotions and what you were going through in your head?
Yeah.
To kind of seem everything's normal and happy. And
yes.
Help keep the secret.
I think for me, opening up to him that I was seeing this guy, I didn't show how upset I was, and I didn't mention about the child that was supposedly about to be born, but I did say, look, I can't stay working here because he's keeping it a secret. And I did say, there's a few mind games going on, I'm really not happy about it. And I said, I feel like I'm actually going a bit crazy. I said, I can't stay here. And I could tell he sort of doubted me a bit. And it was really difficult for me because I'm thinking, I'm opening up to you, but you don't believe it. And then a few months later, so there was that job's Christmas party. I was invited even though I'd left. I stupidly went because there was another person who really liked me, who was, bless him, a very kind, lovely guy, but I hadn't been interested in him because I'd been interested in this horrible Mr. K. And these two, they ended up having a huge argument on the street. He got really, Mr. K, got really, really drunk. It was really horrible to this guy who had no idea what had been going on. And then it all came out almost like a Bridget Jones scene, which was the only sort of comedic way I could see. They were fighting on the street over me. And then Mr. K brought up about the child. And he said, so this is a couple of months now later, because now it's December. He said, no, oh yeah, that child, it was born, but it died and you don't care. And so this was very awkward because I didn't know any of this.
Said that to who?
He shouted this to, and this guy who was interested in me. And so no one had heard any of this. So that was sort of the big bombshell sort of thing. But
It's really abuse 101, the whole thing, the like keeping big secrets like that so you can use them for strategic reasons.
Yes.
Encouraging you to be isolated from your friends and colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
Even just the like weird loose boundaries of like you kind of live here but it's not official, like yes. The whole thing is mm-hmm. is set up to undermine you and question yourself.
Yeah, it's like I had no foundations at all. Everything had sort of like crumbled and I had no idea. I was trying to put those little building blocks down, yeah. Like in terms of, okay, am I sort of living here? Let's try and put some things
here. And so all you've got left is really to put that in the other person.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. So when all this came out, and it was just an absolutely crazy night, and I hadn't been seeing as much of Mr. K as before, because since leaving that job, I had been trying to put myself as much as I could into my studies and into this now new part-time job as well.
Mm-hmm.
But he was basically clicking his fingers and I'd come running. So it still was, I'm not even sure, but a few times a week I was seeing him. I think in my mind I thought, well, he is probably seeing other people, but he still was at the time using me for, oh no, but you've got to be thinking about your future because when this baby's born. Then he'd gone quite quiet after, I think it was after one of the times when he said implied he was with someone else. In his flat, he said something like, oh look, you're young and you're good to look at, but that's about it. Yes, I was feeling top of the world, so I think,
yeah, well, you know, he is the center of your world.
Yeah,
that's whose validation you're looking for.
Yes, so I was just absolutely lost, and I was pretty much drifting through those few months. But after that night, then I remember it was over Christmas and I spoke to a friend who was working for this new job. And I told her about it all because I felt I have to now after all this. And she said, I don't even think this baby ever existed. She said, I think he's created the whole thing. And she'd been in an abusive relationship and just said, look, this is abuse. She said, you should not see him again. And she said, but I feel you're going to. And as I'm out with her, he texts saying, I miss you. What are you doing for New Year or something? And that was when she was like, look, you have to tell him that you're not going to see him again because he's using you. And I remember I was just shaking, but I was thinking I need to make my mind up on my own about this. But at the same time, I thought, if I don't send something now, I will go and see him again. And so it was then. She helped me phrase a text to him. And I did say something along the lines of, like, it doesn't, you know, you've absolutely fucked up my mind. I don't know who I am anymore. I've given you everything. You've given me absolutely nothing back. And I said, I have to go. Like, good luck. You need some help. Pretty much. And then just sent it. And then I deleted his number. But of course, It was a good moment, but at the same time, I was so messed up. And then just going home.
And he's the default person you would go to
when
you're worried.
Yes, and I've just told this. She went on to be quite a good friend, but she wasn't at the time, you know, she was just someone who I had to speak to because she was there. But at the same time, probably I wouldn't have told any of my older, closer friends because I was embarrassed about what had happened because I thought I wouldn't have ever allowed myself to get in that situation, I think.
Yeah. This is all very familiar to me, this experience. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't really understand, you know, the psychological element to these kind of relationships, that you do feel incredibly trapped and you feel like that person is everything. And particularly when they're such high level controlling like that, it's easy for them to come across as being the person with all the answers.
Yes.
And so even when your problem is with them, they're still the one you go to for more answers. And so, you know, there'd obviously been occasions where you'd suspected he was cheating and plenty where you knew that he was. Were these conversations that you ever had with him, and how did those go?
I think it had all been done, a lot of that relationship in the evening. We were both, like, we would drink a lot of alcohol. So my whole gap year pretty much was, because I was meant to go travelling, but I've always been bad with money. So it was instead, get a job to fund the travelling. Oh, no, I've got a job and I'm spending all my wages on drinking. And that's how we ended up getting together in the first place. And so whenever things would be brought up, it's alcohol-fueled. So it was never, I don't think we ever had any good conversation whatsoever. And I think the good times we had were probably when we were drunk as well. So there was nothing, we didn't, I don't think we did much sober at all, other than work together. But then it was like we were acting at the beginning, you know, so then I'm thinking, oh, this is, you know, a secret. But then it just went absolutely stale and I hated it, because then I felt trapped, because then I wanted to be able to speak to people but felt I couldn't. After, I think it was, yeah, after New Year, so I'm trying to tell myself, no, let's get my life back on track. It was difficult because he didn't have a car. If he had, that would have been really tough, because, of course, there's three doors down. I would have known when he was in or not. But instead, it's when I'm driving. He knew my car because, of course, he'd been in it enough times, you know, driving him around everywhere.
Just driving him around.
I was like his taxi service, like, too much. But, yeah, so I was thinking, he knows when I'm in. And I hated that. And because he did text me a couple of times, say, and again, it would be a late night thing. Like, oh, I'm lonely. Where are you? And I was just ignoring. But that was tough, because a lot of the time I am thinking about him, because I found you don't remember the bad things. Oh, you remember the good things. Even though right now I couldn't give you one good thing. But right then I was flooded with all these good memories of him and just hating myself in that I'd done something wrong.
Yeah. And you can end up convincing yourself a lot, you know, as much as they're convincing you that the relationship is good and that they mean so much to you and you do so much for them. Which, first of all, if you're in a healthy relationship, the other person never needs to convince you that you love them. Or, you know, constantly sell themselves to you. But it sounds like you were also doing that a lot to yourself, which is understandable, because the longer you're in such a relationship and the more you're hiding it from friends or not talking about it to certain people because you fear their judgment, the more you have to rationalize that by saying, oh, but I love them.
Yes.
And so therefore it's okay, you know. The outside world doesn't understand, and that's the kind of mentality that they're reinforcing too.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's, and you do just end up in this bubble, really. It's just a very toxic bubble. And then it's so difficult. And then at the end of it, even when I tried to get out, of course you are basically a broken person. That's how you feel anyway, because it had become a habit for even how I was behaving, how I was thinking. And so to try and recover from that, I didn't know what to do. And it felt, is he still near? I don't know. It then came a few months later, the same person who I confided in, who I used to work with, who I had told I had been dating, Mr. K, he messaged me and he just said, I just remember the message was like, oh, Emma, I'm so sorry, I doubted you. He said, we found a bill to Mr. K, and it was to the address, which is basically three doors away from where my parents lived. And so he said, I'm so sorry, I really didn't.
So he didn't even believe that he lived near
you? No. So they'd all thought, oh,
you were just making it all up. But that's crazy. But then also I wonder to what extent that was where you were, because, you know, you would have hardly been at your most kind of compelling and convincing, because you were dealing with so much self-doubt.
Yes.
And plus the anxiety and the depression, plus, you know, you've got that feeling of going behind his back just by even speaking to this person.
Yes.
And so, you know, maybe it, to a certain extent, it was easier for him not to believe you.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, when I got that message, it was sort of a feeling of relief, but also it showed me how much of a web I'd been sort of spun into as well, because, well, yeah, I'd been doubting everything, just like what you said. And it was then trying to work out, okay, what is now going to be my reality? Yeah, I just couldn't make any sense of it as well. And when people talk about, like, closure after relationships, and I was thinking, well, it's so difficult because, yeah, I just didn't know how to move on. And because my self-worth was, yeah, just in the gutter, and it was very difficult for me to build on that. And, yeah, and I was at university trying to do this sort of carefree life, but I had all this stuff going on in my mind. So the bonds I then made with friends at university weren't properly strong. I still felt I was acting because I didn't want to bring up everything that had been going on.
And were you getting any kind of support at that point?
Not really. It's even now, and this is what, over 10 years ago, it's still quite a blur remembering back to then, because I think I just got through it I know I threw myself into working more than university because I just thought, let's just try and earn some money, because I was really annoyed of how much debt I got myself into over the relationship.
Wow, yeah.
It was thousands. And I just felt really annoyed at myself, because even when you try and move yourself on mentally, then you get a, you know, statement. It was like an Argos card I'd taken out for him, an egg card, all these things. You know, you just get those constant reminders, just being like, oh my gosh. And yeah, it was so difficult to shift and be like, no, it's okay, I'm moving forward. So yeah, I did find that very tough. I think I pretty much just shut myself off and just tried to, I think I just was going through the motions of, okay, well, you're at uni, so just try and do whatever you can to get this degree. But I sort of lost any passion. So yeah, I think I was just sort of in this numb state for quite some time, I think.
And did you feel able to open up to others about what was going on for you and in your mind at uni?
I think I remember I spoke to one girl and she was, you know, nice person, but we weren't properly close because I'd been so guarded. And so they got one persona of me and that's it. And then the good thing when you do an acting degree, when you're on stage, that's brilliant. But when you're actually socializing, so I don't think I really connected with that many people at university. And I remember I just told her all about it. And I just remember her face. She just said, wow, I don't know what to say. And she said, like, that's horrific. And then I thought, like, oh, dear, maybe I shouldn't have said anything. I was feeling good to have spoken. But when I had started speaking, it's that sort of thing when it's like a waterfall, you can't really stop. And I felt almost embarrassed there. It felt good for me, but also I was embarrassed. And then when you then have a lot of self-doubt, then I remember then being home and then feeling really anxious. Like, oh, no, have I scared her off now? I've told her about this. But no, I mean, she was a good friend.
Yeah, and it's really great that she believed you, because so often it's easier not to believe that these things happen.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, especially in a sort of drama school environment when it can be quite a few things can be seen to be exaggerated as well. Yeah, it was good to actually just be listened to, I think, because I know that when I was saying it was so fast, and I think I was saying it so quickly because I was probably expecting that I would be judged and that they would think I'm making it up, I think.
May I ask, was he ever physically abusive?
Like, he would... So, this is where it's difficult for me to sort of say, like, he didn't ever, like, punch me or anything, but there were, like... I remember I woke up one day and he was saying, get out of bed or whatever, and I hadn't really woken up, and then he sort of just kicked me out of the bed. There are a few things like that. He didn't threaten, like, physically, mm-hmm. like, abusing me, but he definitely was physically rough with me. I definitely ended up having sex with him a few times when I did not want to, definitely. But at the time, it was because in my mind, it was like, oh, but he's my world. And it's that whole thing when looking back, I'm like, oh my gosh. But I was doing the whole thing, oh, but I'm with him, he's my boyfriend.
Yeah.
So that definitely, in terms of like physical in that way, but not physical in terms of punching and things like that.
Yeah, the reason I ask is because something I see a lot is that people tend to have this kind of very like hard and fast way of thinking when it comes to physical abuse.
Mm.
That, like, as soon as they hit you, you need to get out. That's that. But then when it comes to the emotional abuse, then it's all different shades. And that's where often people can want to explain away that.
Yeah.
Whereas it's a lot more difficult to explain away a black eye.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I know there are a few times like when he'd be sort of guilt tripping me to do things, shall we say. And then if I didn't, then he'd be saying like, oh, who's going to want you? No one's going to want you anyway. So he'd be like, oh, feel free to walk out the door because no one's going to want you and things like that. He'd say that a lot.
Yeah.
And I remember just sort of being there in his flat, just thinking like, oh, my gosh, this isn't right. But not doing anything about it. So I wouldn't argue. I wouldn't. Again, I think it was more I'd shut down to everything. I think, and so it was just this state, and even like after, like, so there'd be sometimes like I'd be working at this other place, but I'd still go and see him, and I'd know on my way walking to his place that I'm not going to enjoy myself at all, but I would just go through the motions, like, oh no, I'm going to see him because he's my boyfriend, and yeah, it's those
yeah,
things.
And that kind of shutting down is very conducive to you not only not working on the relationship but not working on yourself. You know,
yes.
Your self-esteem remains tied to him. Your mental health remains tied to, is he having a good day or a bad day towards me?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because you'd never know. He'd never be in a great mood, but he'd be either in, I was going to say mediocre, but no, it wasn't even that. He'd be in a bad mood or he'd be in a foul mood, but he wasn't a angry person. He was just a very, very low person. I think he needed a lot of help, but he wasn't going to seek it at all. yeah, he told me quite a bit about his dad, and there definitely were quite a few problems there. And I've been saying, oh, why don't you get some help? And each time he'd sort of bat it off and he'd say, oh, you young girls, you don't know what you're talking about. It's like, okay, right, thanks.
Yeah, yeah, so he really held the age thing over you.
Yes, absolutely. And he did start making me feel, and again, I was young, but I did have some independence and things, but he was disregarding it. There was no interest in me as a person. I think, well, I'm not too sure what he got out of being with me, other than it probably made him feel superior or something. But yeah, everything for myself was made to feel that I didn't know anything. And, oh, yeah, you can get a degree, but you still know nothing. And, oh, yeah, but you're pretty, so that's it.
Well, that's, I imagine he would have got a lot out of you because you're great company. Mm. And he got to have that whenever he wanted.
On
tap.
You
had no control of the relationship. And, you know, that included sex.
Mm.
You'd have sex when he wanted sex.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, that's, I can see definitely, as toxic as it was, that he was getting quite a lot out of the controlling nature of that relationship.
Yeah, I think he probably maybe towards the end just got bored because of that sort of consistency. Just, I think maybe that's why he, I don't know if he did cheat on me, he was saying there was someone else there. It wouldn't surprise me, but at the same time, looking back at the time, I thought he was this amazingly, really good-looking person. He wasn't, but, you know, so there was me thinking, oh, he could get anyone he wanted. No, it was probably more if we want to be, you know, like that and cold and materialistic. I could have got anyone I wanted at the time more, but I didn't see it. So it was him just doing this horrible reverse psychology on me, really, I think.
Yeah, and it sounds like the way he was behaving, he needed somebody that would be easier to control.
Yes.
That, you know, it's, yes, he might have got chatting to any girl he wanted to at a bar, but that doesn't necessarily mean it will develop into something, because they would have the self-esteem or the social grounding or whatever it was, be in a better place to not fall trapped to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So that was that one.
Yeah, because it just made me think about my experience, because I was really trying to figure out where I fit in the time when I had a relationship like this start. You know, it was very much a time of like, I'm getting my business going. I know that I want to be self-employed, but I don't know what in.
Mm.
I was in and out of different jobs to like help pay for everything in the meantime. But I knew that there wasn't a particular, what I refer to as a job.
Yes.
Like there wasn't an employment out there that would suit me. And from a young age, I knew that the kind of things my parents and my family had aspired to were just so different to what I wanted. It was more so a certain lifestyle of being self-employed as opposed to one particular profession.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really in a period of not being, like yourself, too long out of school, still figuring out my identity, still figuring out my work life. And it can make you very prey to somebody that basically tells you they have all the answers.
Yes.
And that they're here for you and they're going to support your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And it, as it continues, you realise how conditional that all is.
Absolutely, yes.
And for me, I think it wasn't until I got out of that relationship I realised how bad things were. And the thing that I remember overwhelmingly shortly afterwards was how much free time I had. Not just like time that I suddenly had back, but emotional time as well.
Yeah.
Like how much worrying, how much constantly filtering my life through the lens of this other person was going on.
Yes.
And then I get out of the relationship and I'm like, I've lost touch with half my friends. What? Like, yeah. I didn't even know it was happening because yes. All I knew was, oh, I'm being social all the time. I'm always with you.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely being sociable.
Yes, because then it's, oh, yeah, no, no, they're always out. It's like, yeah, but that doesn't mean, it's like, yeah, with one person, that's it. Yeah. Yes. I think it's always quite interesting looking back. I feel that almost sounds lonely, but I don't see it as that. Like when you're on your own, to actually be able to get your own thoughts and be able to sort of ground yourself. And then for me, yeah, it was put those foundations in place and start like rebuilding them. And it does take forever. But then when you start entering into another relationship, for me, I got really like the walls just shot up because I was just petrified then of thinking, okay, because I've rebuilt myself. And then it was, okay, if I'm going to be in a relationship, I have to show them some sort of vulnerability, but I can't take down the walls completely because then what if they trying to sort of spin me again, even though you tell yourself, no, that was just a bad experience. But you do start thinking, well, okay, how can I do this to protect myself, but also not be harsh on this person, because this new person, it's not their fault that what the ex did. But yeah, it's...
Yeah, I found myself kind of generalising in a way that looking back is discrimination. So she had her own like mental health issues. And so that was a lot of why these kind of controlling behaviours came out.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, looking back on it, she did need me a lot more than I needed her.
Yeah.
But at the time when you're constantly being told the opposite and you're spending so much time around that person,
yes,
and I'm still figuring out my own worth in a relationship, that I didn't have any of that clarity.
Mm.
And so I did go through a period afterwards, which now as a mental health podcaster, I feel quite bad about, where I was saying to myself, okay, your next relationship needs to be with someone neurotypical.
Mm.
You know, you can't go near anyone with mental illness. And, you know, that's crazy because I didn't realise at the time I had depression, but I was diagnosed since then. And looking back, I understand that that was part of all this as well.
Yeah.
So it's crazy for me to be in that hypocritical way. But luckily, my next relationship was a lot more stable and just remarkably relaxed in comparison.
Yes.
And so that really level things back out again.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of kind of was a bit of an equalizer, and so I was able to move forward with an ability to separate. No, that was how she was reacting to and mismanaging mental illness, as well as other things she had going on, like personally and socially and family wise. It was her toxic ways of moving through those whilst not really dealing with any of them that was the problem, not the the kind of situation on paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a good point. We probably don't even have time for this, but I was going to say, yeah, since myself being diagnosed with my current relationship with my partner, we've had almost what you were saying there, when I was trying to protect myself, my own well-being, and that for me, I can freeze sometimes, and then it can come across in a negative in terms of the relationship. And so trying to get a healthy relationship, but with understanding that for me to keep myself okay, there have to be things put in place. Like, for instance, I don't like people just randomly turning up at the flat. It makes me really anxious. But for him, he's come from an open home. So when anyone can come in, when he first asked me to move in, next thing I know, his dad's just popping around, you know, making himself a cup of tea. And it absolutely just freaks me out. And so to begin with, and I do feel I have a bit of a people pleaser tendency still, but I'm working on, but it's still there. And so I wouldn't be saying, oh, please, next time, can you let me know? Because I'd be so scared that I'd offend. So I'd take it on. It would be lots of little things like that, and then build. And then I would just snap, and I'd be horrible to my partner. And he's lovely. And he's just, yeah, I'm very lucky with him, especially after sort of what I've been through and sort of learning, you know, who is the right sort of person. But it was more my inability to communicate and to be calm. And it sort of, and again, it's the self-worth thing, to be confident and know that for myself, no, I'm a good person, but I just need this, you know, a few things just to look after myself. And I'm not hurting anyone else. It is just purely for my own well-being. But I think sometimes I can really panic and, oh, but how's this going to come across to them? Are they going to think I don't like them? I'd rather put myself through, for me, a horrible, like, evening meal out or social engagement to try and keep everyone happy. But even though then I can go back and I end up having panic attacks because it's too much for me. So it's trying to balance that out in terms of a relationship to keep it nice and this is what I need for us and for me, without it turning into a problem within the relationship, if that makes sense.
No, that absolutely makes sense. It's separating what is to do with your current partner and what isn't.
Absolutely.
And out of interest, do you have any kind of tools or techniques you use to stop yourself getting into such a relationship now?
I was really guarded, and I was single for quite some time before meeting my current partner. So with this one, I definitely did go wrong in the beginning, because instead I thought, oh, I've been so guarded for so long that when I did meet him, I was sort of blown away by how lovely he is. And that luckily wasn't an area of judgment, whereas in the past it had been, because that's it. When you do get into a really bad relationship, and especially what I was in, an abusive relationship, you do start questioning yourself. So definitely for the first couple of months, I was thinking, is he going to appear on Crime Watch? He didn't, so that was good. But then you do start thinking, okay, he is really lovely. But then I let my guard down to the point I was trying to behave and be a person I thought he wanted me to be, as opposed to just being myself. Mm. And that was the biggest mistake I made in this relationship. Been with each other almost 4 years now, but it definitely because I was trying to just behave what is expected of me, what was expected of me in that relationship. So, for instance, he's very close to his family and he wanted to go round every weekend to go and see them. I did it, but then my hair started falling out and things like that. So I thought, oh dear, I was feeling really overwhelmed, but I thought, just because I'm not used to doing this sort of thing doesn't mean I shouldn't. So let's be open to doing this. But I was, I was always absolutely like clammy hands, like sweating, but just trying to act all calm. And I think that's where being an actor really doesn't help in those situations, because I was just guarding it all and no one had a clue about it. So then they're expecting more and more. I'm being invited to many more events and I'm freaking out, but not telling anyone. And then it was, my hair started falling out. And that was when the doctor said, are you under any stress? So, oh, no, not really. And then it was like, oh, actually, this isn't this. And then it was trying to communicate it. So, yeah, that's sort of what I wish I had have done. But at the same time, you can't beat yourself up about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a learning process. And you really had to learn step by step how to pay attention to your needs. Mm-hmm. Because your first kind of real exposure to a relationship was the complete opposite. It was all about him.
Yes.
And so you kind of had to learn from scratch and catch up with your peers on how do I look after me and work on my happiness so I can be a good partner. Yes. You've got to do a certain amount of self-work in order to be a good partner in the first place.
Absolutely. And I still think that's definitely something that I still am constantly needing to work on. I'm definitely too much of a people pleaser.
It's a real process. One thing that I did ever since that relationship is I now have this two strike rule. So I kind of had this system in my head that people get two strikes. Luckily, no one in a relationship has got two strikes, although I'm single now, so they've obviously still ended. But it has happened with friends where they've engaged in certain behaviours that really disregard my feelings, or they kind of keep doing the same bad things again and again. But now that I have this rule, it really helps, because once someone's done something twice, they're probably going to do it again, because I've never had a situation where the two strikes are for different things. It's always been something like somebody's got in a relationship and they abandon all their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get in another relationship, it happens again. So I don't stay around for that to happen the third time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been something really interesting to learn, that I associated so much of this stuff with romantic relationships.
Yes.
But actually, I think I'd learned to put up with a lot more in all kinds of relationships. And I'm really glad I'm stricter on that now.
Mm. Do you ever bring it up? So when you've got your two-strike rule, would you then sort of, after strike one, do you sort of say to your friend like how it's making you feel? Not letting them know they're on a warning, but do you try to communicate?
Yeah, I definitely try and communicate. I will not tell them they've had a strike, because whilst many of them understand, like I've mentioned it to them, people would react so badly at being called out, they're not used to a kind of systematic conditionality for relationships. But that's what I needed to protect myself. And it still continues to work for me, so I think I'll certainly keep it for the foreseeable. I do make a thing of the few times I have kind of done that door slam of the second strike, I tell them something's happening with our relationship, it keeps happening, and so we're just going to leave it here. I've been known to use the phrase, I'm just going to tap out.
Nice.
And generally that's something where they have quite a strong reaction at that point, because they've kind of been called out on something and they've realised that that's their chance gone.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, again, this hasn't happened frequently, but each time it has happened, the person's come back several months later and be like, oh, I'm sorry, I realised that such and such a behaviour was because of this, not because of you, or I kept telling you you were doing something and actually it was all me, whatever it was. And so that's been quite interesting. They've actually had to be forced to reassess things.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's brilliant, because then at least they get some growth from it as well. Hopefully they get something from it.
Yeah, it's no harm for me to hear either when somebody texts me months later to be like, oh yeah, you were right, I was super shitty to you. I'm like, oh, well, that's nice to have that confirmed.
Exactly, that acknowledgement, yeah.
We're on that note, we will wrap up. So thank you so much for being on the show again today. If you want to hear more from Emma, you can go back to our mental health education mini-series, where I believe you're episode 1.
But yes, I believe I am, yeah.
All right, well, hopefully. And Would you like to share a little bit of where people can find you online and the work you do now?
Yes, sure. So I've got a theatre company. It's called Real Talk Theatre. It's www.realtalktheatre.co.uk. You can do it without the www.
Did I tell you that last time?
I think you did, yeah. I just remembered it as I was saying. Yeah, and we do interactive workshops and performances about mental health and wellbeing, and that's to primary schools and secondary schools. We're hoping to also take that into workplaces from next year. Yeah, I mean, we're on Facebook. You can find us. It's at Real Talk Theatre Company, and we've got an Instagram as well. Yeah, I think that's all right, isn't it? You can see that's me trying to sell myself again. It's brilliant.
No, it really is brilliant, and you can learn a lot more about it by listening to that previous episode. It's really such valuable work.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll wrap it there. Thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you. And thank you very much for having me back. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.